The Guardian.
Hello, welcome to the last Politics Weekly of 2010. I'm Tom Carr.
I'm Allegra Stratton. And joining us in our studio to reflect on a tumultuous year in British politics, we have The Observer's Raphael Baer, Guardian columnists Michael White and Jackie Ashley. Welcome to you all.
We'll hear a lot later on from a selection of MPs and we'll discuss what we can expect 2011 to bring. But first, let's look back at 2010, a year that sounded just a little bit like this.
Jeff and I thought about this very, very carefully, and we came to the conclusion that the best way, indeed the only way, to settle this once and for all is to have a secret ballot. Just give Labour MPs the chance to vote.
This Labour cabinet, it's a team, it works well, and it's a team that will be actually fighting an election on the basis of the big issues.
Isn't about a lie or a conspiracy or a deceit or a deception, it's a decision. And the decision I had to take was, given Saddam's history, given his use of chemical weapons, given the over 1 million people...
If you've ever looked at the Liberal Democrats and thought, they've got the right ideas, but can they deliver? This manifesto is your answer. We can, we will.
I agree with Ned!
The northwest of England is tonight host to a British political first.
We've got to do more, and that means we've got to tighten the number
we've
of skills...
We've had 13 years of a government that's now only started to talk about addressing this issue.
No, very, very, very easily. They do it in other countries. It basically means that if you're an...
10 o'clock. And this is what we're saying. It's going to be a hung parliament with the Conservatives as the largest party.
On the steps of Downing Street yesterday evening, I said that Nick and I wanted to put aside party differences and work together in the national interest. Since I set out that aim, both our parties have given their full backing to our coalition agreement.
My resignation as leader of the Labour Party will take effect immediately. And in this hour, I want to thank all my colleagues.
I therefore declare Ed Miliband the winner and the leader of the Labour Party.
I first joined this party at the age of 17. Never in my wildest imagination did I believe that I would one day lead this party.
Jackie, you look back and you think, God, Patricia Hewitt talking about kicking Gordon Brown out. It's been a long old year. Do you feel it was sort of inevitable we got to where we were at the end of it?
No, not really. I have to confess, I was one of those that thought Labour could still win and Labour and the Lib Dems could form a coalition. I got it all wrong. I didn't really believe this would happen. I actually think that, had David Miliband actually moved when James Purnell went, David Miliband could be Prime Minister now. But there we are. It was never to be. All those Labour conspirators never quite got their act together, did they?
So that was a missed moment of 2009 rather than this one. Anything stand out for you?
I got it wrong in a different way. I thought that after the first 6-8 months of Gordon Brown, A, that Brown was pretty well doomed, and B, that there wasn't anybody with either the capacity or the bottle, A, to get rid of him, and B, to persuade the electorate that was a good idea. So I thought Gordon was Labour's destiny, and that would end in April or May of 2010 with defeat. But I thought there'd be a Tory majority government, and then during the campaign, a Tory minority government. The idea that they could cut a deal with the Lib Dems and form a coalition barely crossed my mind. Although I did look at the history books, I know these things happen. I was astonished.
I have to admit, I was also confident until very late that there would be a Tory majority of around 20 or 30 seats. And for me, I think a large reason why that didn't happen was one of the most interesting things of the year, which was the TV debates. The Lib Dem surge was a bit of a fiction in many respects, but what it did do is take from Cameron so much of the message that he wanted to deliver of being a fresh, new candidate representing something essentially different from what people felt had been politics before that. It was enough to destabilise his campaign at a crucial moment, and I think that helped a lot in terms
of... We had the same epiphany moment then, roughly. That's roughly how it felt to me. And I later heard from, Douglas Alexander, they deliberately decided to play Clegg. He must be in the TV debates. We'll have a TV debate as a sort of poison the wells, blow up the bridges tactic. They knew they had lost, but they knew Clegg could help Cameron lose too. In fact, everybody lost that election, didn't they?
If we were looking back a year, at the end of 2009, after expenses, everyone was saying, oh, we want a new politics, not least of all the Guardian, which ran a whole big series about it. We've got a new politics now, but the country doesn't seem too chuffed with it. And Nick Clegg, the great hero of the year in the sense that he got his party into government for the first time in 90 years, comes out of it as one of the most hated figures in Britain.
Well, we're unlucky. Nick Clegg's very unlucky in that he wanted to embody new politics, and at the same time, the most emblematic thing that he has done in the public's eye is to renege on a pledge that he personally signed with his own hand in front of a camera. Now, I feel a certain degree of political sympathy in that when you engage in what is essentially a campaigning stunt like that, you don't expect it to blow up in your face quite in the way that it has.
You expect to be in government then.
But nonetheless, if you want to try and legitimise coalition as a tonic for the British political establishment and something that will transform the way we do politics, you can't also then turn it into a licence to jettison any policy that you didn't particularly like a few months later. And so the new politics is just, I think, is essentially has run into the ground by the end of the year. No one's going to talk about that next year.
Jackie, do you think one young Ed Miliband started the year thinking he'd be leader by the end?
I think Ed always had a little plan to run, because from quite early on people were saying, oh, David's not quite there, David's too like Blair, David's too wonky. And Ed Miliband always thought his moment might come. I think when he entered the campaign, he sort of thought, well, he was in with a little chance. And then throughout the summer, he was saying, I think I'm going to win. I think I'm going to win.
God, I'm going to win. Damn.
And I think when he did win, he was still shocked. I mean, his face was a picture, wasn't it? The day of the result, he looked deeply shocked. And I think it's taken him a few weeks, months even, to get over that shock, to get over what he's done to David, and to try to deal with all the David supporters who are still very angry with him. So
he
starts to sort of really pull his leadership together in the new year. He was unlucky in that his paternity leave, which he had to take, came so early in his leadership. So hopefully in the new year he will start to get his act together. I'm not quite convinced his new strategy team is the perfect one, but I wait to be proved wrong.
What about David Cameron? He's the new Prime Minister. He's the man of the year in that sense, Mike?
Well, he certainly is, and he's played a difficult hand well, by and large. The moment for me which made me think, oh, this bloke can do it. You always have that moment with politicians, they can or they can't. I've yet to make my mind up about Ed Miliband, but was Cameron handling the Savile Inquiry report with a huge crowd out there in the
Bloody Sunday
Square on Bloody Sunday, yes, and getting applause from an Irish Catholic crowd, and I thought he got the tone pretty well, he wrote it himself, and I was pleased with that, because, you know, whether or not you vote for people, it's our country, he's our Prime Minister, you want them to do well. Other events, he's fallen below the level of performance which the situation required. I think he's constantly disappointing on the economy. I thought at Prime Minister's Question Time, the last one which we had this week, that, you know, he's, as Ed Miliband rightly said, he's a broad brush man and an airbrush man. He was talking nonsense about the NHS and the expenditure therein, depressingly so, because he's not stupid. I think he's the chairman of the board rather than the chief executive, and that will get him into trouble, because Tory MPs tell me, junior minister told me during the week, number 10's in chaos. They don't have any policy specialists in the way that Blair and Brown did. They've got to get a grip.
And they had a fractious 1922 committee meeting on Wednesday. When do you think Nick Clegg mismanaged things this year? When was the moment to which he could have saved it all, could have saved his reputation?
Well, it's difficult. You see, Ralph said the new politics is dead. I think that's quite true, actually. I think we are in sort of three, possibly four-party politics. We may get some versions of PR. The old order doesn't work properly, so it's sort of half new. In that ridiculous photo call for a policy tuition fee stuff, which he didn't believe in and was trying to edge away before the election, to have done that merely tells you that he never expected to be within a million miles of government, and wouldn't have been if he and Cameron...
But he did. He had a hung parliament team working on this stuff for a year beforehand.
A hung parliament is different. Being in coalition... Where he would take the... So the answer to Ruff's question is they won't ever do it again, because now the possibility of coalition for the first time since 1922... voters have short memories, bless them. We all have short memories, even the hacks do, even in the age of the internet. And, you know, things will heal, things will come round. I'm sure that come election day, tuition fees will not be the issue which decides, for better or for worse,
but I think
the fate
trust
of Nick Clegg.
Will be. I think we talk about the new politics, and the new politics means many different things. It is partly the three-party system and AV and all that, but it's above all the new politics and the way the The Guardian was running. It was about trust, wasn't it? It was about people saying what they mean, meaning what they say, and sticking to a promise. And that's where Nick Clegg, during those debates, he seemed to be the honest guy. He came from outside. He seemed to say what he meant. And I think of that, all the issues to go on that one where he signed the pledge and then reneged on it, I think that will dog him forever.
Why are you disagreeing so vehemently, Mike?
Well, I think you could flip that argument and say, trouble is the voters, you can't trust them, you know. They want cuts, but they don't want cuts here. They want this, they want that. They want better services for less money and lower tax. Trust is a two-way street. And all this talk we'd thrive on, particularly in this building, about trust, openness and transparency, has been hugely corrosive of trust. We have ridiculous expectations of our politicians, and they have, let it be said, particularly Nick Clegg, ridiculous expectations of themselves.
Which is, I think, why the biggest winner politically in this year is without doubt one, George Osborne, because he's absolutely thoroughly political in a very Westminster Orthodox way, down to his fingertips. He knows how to withdraw from the limelight if he doesn't think he's going to be popular. He knows how to play the system. He has never for a moment been taken in by or aspired to be anything other than a very shrewd political operator. He was being talked down at the beginning of the year. People thought Ken Clark should be Chancellor because that he would give more gravitas. He was being briefed against by the city as an ingenue, and he's played an absolute blinder this year.
It's interesting. I mean, of course, everything now depends for next year with Osborne on whether or not reality intervenes and the plan A that he's pinned his reputation on survives. So let's just now put away the rearview mirror and grab out the crystal ball, because 2011 is going to bring a whole load of things, starting with a by-election in January, and then there's around of Scottish elections, local elections, a royal wedding, in case we need some distraction, and an interestingly divisive referendum on the voting system. Mike White, before he got here, has been out asking MPs as they go about their business what they're looking forward to. First up, Tory MP for West Suffolk and ally of Osborne, Matthew Hancock.
2011 is all about making sure that the coalition delivers on what it's set out so far. So it's a matter of keeping on track and putting through all of the things that have been announced so far. And then, of course, there's a couple of big bullet points through the year, the local elections and the AV elections, AV referendum in particular.
And on the AV referendum, since you've mentioned it, A, how will you be campaigning? And B, what do you think the result will be?
I'll be campaigning for a no vote, and I think that'll be the result.
2011, Angus Robertson, big year in Scotland, devolution elections for the Holyrood Parliament in May. What's going to happen? What's going to happen to your charismatic leader, Alex Salmon?
Well, there are only two parties that can win the Scottish elections, and that would see either the re-election of an SNP government with Alex Salmond as First Minister. I'm obviously in favour of that. I think a lot of people in Scotland are. Or we might see a return of the Labour Party to office with an anonymous leader that very few people know.
That's Mr. Gray.
Apparently, yes.
I'm told he's doing better now.
Well, I'm here. I'm going to talk about the SNP and what it's done in government, and the fact that I think most people will say they'd far rather have what looks and sounds like a government than the old regime that wasn't. And I think it's a big choice. It's a big choice as to whether we want Scotland to move forward and have ambition or not. And that's why I'm confident that when the choice is laid out, it is about re-electing an SNP government, is about re-electing Alex Salmond as First Minister, people will do just that.
Ah, there's Mike Gapes, Labour MP for Ilford South. Let's see what he makes of it all. Michael, what's 2011 going to be like, and how's it different from the year just ending?
I think the impact of the VAT rise and the impact of the cuts on local government, rising unemployment. This year we've had the legacy of the quantitative easing and the measures taken
by the Bank of England.
That's right.
Yep.
We've had the legacy of that, and therefore the brutality of what's going to happen has not really made an impact.
How do you think it's going to pan out for the Lib Dems? They seem to be the human shield for the Tories at the moment. And what about the fringe parties, left and right?
I think there is a real danger of extremists growing in this climate, both on the far left and on the far right. But I also think this is a challenge for those of us who believe in democratic politics. We've got to be at the head of the protest and lead the way for the country to reject these proposals. As regards the Lib Dems, I think they're toast. I think they are involved in a Stockholm syndrome. They've taken their position. They are being held hostage by the Tories, and they've made their choice?
I've just got Andrew George, MP for St Ives, my favourite town. Short answer is 2011 going to be the worst year for the Coalition, and particularly for the Lib Dems? You're down in single figures in the polls.
Well, it's going to be a five-year contract, this Coalition. We never said it was going to be easy. I mean, the fact is that when we made the decision, it was the least worst option. We knew that there was a rocky road ahead. All of the other options invited us to swallow some form of catastrophe or another. And as a party that wants a voting system that would produce coalitions forever and a day, we clearly have to demonstrate that we're mature enough to put, if you like, the best interests of the party aside and do what's in the best interests of the country and the political process.
Throughout every answer, or most of the answers, there was some kind of emphasis on the AV referendum and whether it comes through. Mike, how important, or rather, if they don't get a yes, if they don't get a change to the voting system, does it make the Coalition less likely to survive?
Well, I think we're sort of past that. I think they're clinging to the I was going to say to the wreckage, but that's a bit premature. They're in the lifeboat together, and they'll stay in the lifeboat. If Clegg loses the referendum, my instinct is that he will, for a variety of reasons I'll come back to. He'll just say, well, I never particularly liked this system anyway, and we've tried it, and we'll have to try again, and opportunities will arise. The public mood, back to Raf's point, the public mood towards politics is changing, and the way we conduct our politics is becoming perhaps more consensual, more collegiate, apart from those fringe parties which Mike Gapes mentioned. But voters will want to punish, I think, by the spring. If Nick Clegg wants something, even if it's only curry and chips, they'll want to deny it him.
What happens if he keeps his head down and Cameron goes out and campaigns for a no, then the protest vote goes the other way?
Well, no, Cameron won't do that. Cameron doesn't have to do anything masterful in activity. He'll have to make a few polite noises. Cameron's vaguely in the no campaign, isn't he?
Yeah.
But he won't do much, and he doesn't have to. It's up to Clegg. He's the man proposing the change, a change which he has previously denounced as defective. AV is an odd system. You can see the point of it, but it's not PR. It's all down to Clegg. It's his idea. It's his show. He's got to win.
And the stakes are very high for Ed Miliband campaigning for a yes vote.
Well, yes, Ed has said he will sort of support it, but not very wholeheartedly. I think that's wrong. I think he should actually go for it. I think far from being worried about being seen to support Nick Clegg, I think it will be in Ed Miliband's interest to really go for it. And I think there are signs that he's considering that and may decide to do so, because I think without it, I can't really see Labour coming back in a big way, especially given all those sort of changes in the numbers of seats and everything.
The other question is, if Labour doesn't come back in a big way, but comes back in a modest sort of way, it's going to need to be able to work with the Lib Dems. So shouldn't they be working, going for it, in your phrase,
Well, we've already
seen a really big change, haven't we, from the election, when sort of Brown and indeed all the negotiators were very, we couldn't possibly work with the Lib Dems, they're dreadful, to kind of, let's, you know, try to win them over, let's be nice to them, let's work with them. And I think at last they're beginning to get it right. They do have to work with the Lib Dems, and they do agree on an awful lot of things. I mean, just coming back to the Coalition and whether it will last, I think far from the AV referendum being crucial, I think it's actually the local elections. I think if the Lib Dems do as badly as I think they will in the local elections, I think that then gives the green light to the likes of Tim Farron, Simon Hughes, whoever wants to do it, to start really mobilising for the next autumn's conference against Nick Clegg. And I think that will be the decider, not so much the referendum on AV.
Peculiarly, the sophologists are saying that if the Lib Dem vote in a local election completely collapses, it's actually quite good for the Tories, because there are enough places where...
It certainly is.
Yeah,
oh, yes.
Where the margins are such that it lets the Tories through the middle. I mean, it's a bit of a cliche, but it is so all about the economy, isn't it? I mean, the VAT goes up, inflation stays stubbornly high, even interest rates have to go up. People who've had low tracker mortgages, who are feeling all right at the moment, suddenly feel a real income squeeze. AV seems like this peculiar preoccupation of people who really ought to be worrying about jobs and growth. And however much potential continuity of political interest there might be elsewhere between Labour and the Lib Dems went along with the single biggest economic, they call it a choice, others call it a gamble, macroeconomically taken in our lifetimes, probably, or certainly my lifetime. And if they're wrong, Labour will have to campaign on that. And it's very difficult to see how Labour and Lib Dems can suddenly find common cause on anything else until that is decided.
Mike, you like to keep an eye on the various constituents of our kingdom. In Scotland, politics was very different this year. Not a single seat changed hands. It's been very different for the Lib Dems traditionally, in the sense that they've always had their fair share of MPs north of the border, which they've never had south. Do you think the Holyrood elections are going to be more interesting than the local elections in London? Will they create more of a ripple? Not London, sorry, England.
Well, they'll certainly be interesting in Scotland, and we may deign south of the border to take a bit of interest, because if the union between England and Scotland ever breaks down, it'll really be because the English have walked away. I'm horrified by the degree of indifference which we display to what goes on up there, unless Tommy Sheridan is on trial. I don't write the SNP off, partly because Alex Salmond is such a formidable campaigner. He's had to retreat on his plans for a referendum on independence on early because the collapse of the Irish economy and the Icelandic economy. Angus Robertson, we heard a moment ago, will say, "Oh, Michael, what about Norway?" He always does, but it doesn't look so good. Jim Gray, the Labour leader, the only other game in town, is getting better, they tell me, rather dull. But nobody knows where the Lib Dem vote will go, except probably not to the Tories, because the Tories still don't get any traction in Scotland. It's very strange.
But there's 10 or 11 or something Lib Dem MPs up there, including Charles Kennedy and Min Campbell. I'm just wondering, at Westminster, does that give it a kind of extra echo if Scotland goes to pieces?
Don't forget Danny Alexander as well.
Danny Alexander, no less, yeah.
The ginger rodent. Shame on you for repeating that unsavoury remark. I think it's just too early to do all that. Holyrood works on a different cycle, and you play, I think Scots voters do what American voters do. You play one end of Pennsylvania off the White House against the Congress, London against Holyrood, one party in power in one, another in the other. That's how people triangulate their votes, you might say.
I suspect that David Cameron is touchier about the fact that they don't break through north of the border, that he doesn't. I think when he says, "I want to be Prime Minister of the United Kingdom," that speaks, I mean, it's a political statement and needs to be taken with a pinch of salt. But he is a nostalgist. He's a conservative.
And isn't he sort of Scottish in the same way that the Queen is?
she's German.
Passing acquaintance with Balmoral. But I suspect it is a source of, in the same way that he gets a little bit cross that people don't take his big society seriously, I think it makes him a little bit cross that Scotland still won't take the Tories back
yield
to their heart.
To the Charles. And what about what Mike Gape was talking about, which was the idea of these extremist parties coming through? They didn't last year, but might they this year?
Well, you have to be careful here, because the number of times people have got very agitated and excited and thought that this is going to be some big BNP breakthrough, or, you know, Respect will suddenly sweep East London. It never does quite seem to happen, although I agree that the circumstances, if the economy takes a turn for the worse and Parliament isn't felt to have got its act together and cleaned itself up, yes, the potential for politics to spill out of Westminster is quite high.
But one of the big stories of the election, wasn't it, was the lack of success of the BNP embarking, where everyone thought, Nick Griffin might come in and take the seat, and actually was completely trounced.
Because of a very, very effective
Labour campaign.
Though, and actually,
yes,
in the same election nationally, the score for sort of none of the above. And now that the Lib Dems are no longer a natural repository for anti-politics protest, there is quite a lot of sort of political capital there ready to be taken by one of the
quick little parties. A little quick question: could the Greens break through? Could they capitalise on Lib Dem unpopularity?
I don't get any sense of
anyone
in
machine.
The Green Party that has enough of a coherent political platform or is saying anything.
At
that
times of
really
cuts and job losses, I think the environmental agenda, I'm afraid, goes to the bottom
Caroline
of the
Lucas
list.
Did,
it
should be recorded. They did get a Green MP at Westminster. I agree with the others. What we're talking here about is angry white working class and lower middle class votes hacked off of the mainstream parties, all in bed with each other, signing each other's expenses. That's where a charismatic figure could come through, but they would come through from the right.
Can I just make a quick point on this, that I think in a peculiar way, I think the British class system will save us from far-right politics, because actually there's a class divide in the far-right between UKIP and the BNP, and that's in that essentially means that the far-right is as riven by sort of class acrimony as the rest of British society, and therefore we are preserved.
UKIP is lower-middle-class Tory disaffection. BNP is white working class. We're what the Labour Party used to be. That's roughly it, is it?
That
okay,
might be
we're going to bookend our discussion with a quick look at the books that have come out, the political books, that is. Julian Glover, our colleague, came in earlier to give us his recommendations.
I think it's been a really exceptional year for political books. We've had the breakdown of one government, an election, and the creation of a new one. And those changes have thrown up really three kinds of books, I think all of them important. The first kind is the sort of retrospective at the end of Labour. We've had Mandelson, Blair, we've had Gordon Brown in a different way talking about the government and what went wrong. And those are sort of looking back books. And they've been good. Blair, I think, was very strange, very readable. Mandelson was much more bitchy and telling than we'd expected. And Brown is just, frankly, unreadable, but in itself defines the man. And then there's a second kind of book about the present, the creation of the present. And those are the books about how the coalition was formed. And we've had a whole crop of instant political histories from people involved, like David Laws, whose books quite worth reading, I think. A Tory MP has also written a history, a sort of accompanying history of the negotiations with lots of interesting conversations. Adam Bolton at Sky has done a book like that too. Those instant history books will move on once we get the people involved talking about it more once they finish their careers. But they're important for the moment. And then there's a third kind of political book, which we haven't had too many of, which is looking forward, policy ideas for the future. We had Nick Bowles from the Tory party, a Tory MP, writing about where he wanted the coalition to go, the ideas he believed mattered for the coalition. And I think that's the kind of book we'll get more of in the next few months. And perhaps one element of that book we haven't had is the Labour book about the future. What's the big Labour idea? And I'm sure in the next 12 months, people will be producing those books. I hope they will, because they certainly need some ideas. They haven't got them yet. If the party leaders get any time to read at Christmas, and I imagine what they'll want to do is to go to bed and go to sleep and try and recover from a very strange year and a shocking time for all of them. I reckon David Cameron ought to be reading the Flashman novels about Afghanistan and the war, because A, it would teach him what went wrong in the war and why Britain shouldn't be involved, and B, maybe he'd hopefully learn how not to be quite so flash and quite so smug and cruel himself. There's the danger he'd just use it as a sort of user's guide on how to behave in the House of Commons. Ed Miliband, well, he needs to read something dark and tormented, really. Maybe The Brothers Karamazov, about, you know, fight inside a family and the harm that can do. And Nick Clegg, well, he just needs cheering up, poor guy. So maybe he should read Scoop, Evening War's book about why journalists aren't really very serious, and he'll stop believing what he reads in the newspapers, smile, and just get on with being Deputy Prime Minister.
Well, then, Jackie Julian there saying, amongst other things, that there's no books so far on the Labour side about what the future is going to be like, which is possibly a serious point. If we compare it to the Tories, where we've had Jesse Norman producing this compassionate conservatism, which, sorry, Big Society it's called, isn't it? But about his compassionate conservatism, it's quite a serious kind of looking to the future. Do you think Labour MPs just haven't had the time to do the equivalent thing, or do you think that they are a bit stuck for ideas at the moment?
Well, it's interesting when Julian says there's no one coming up with the books yet. My first question is, well, who's going to write them, I wonder? And I think that is a real question for Labour. Who are the thinkers at the moment in the Labour Party? There are plenty of people who've been in government, who've served, who are absolutely exhausted, shell-shocked, still can't quite come to terms with the fact that they're out of government now. But they're not really thinking to the future. And there's the younger ones who are coming up, but I think they're just concerned at the moment to make their mark. We're not seeing that kind of intellectual ideas bubbling through that we did see with the Tories. I think it takes a time. I think they have to come to terms with defeat first, accept the leader, because there's a lot of people still obsessing about the leadership and whether it was the right or wrong Miliband. And I think only in the next year or two will we start to see some people coming through, but I still slightly wonder who they're going to be. I don't see many obvious thinkers at the moment in the Labour Party.
No doubt Miliband Senior would write a very polished book if he could calm down. But Raph, was there anything this year that particularly caught your eyes? I mean, obviously the one that grabbed the most attention, well, the two that grabbed the attention were Blair and Mandelson.
Well, I think the best political book I read this year, which was Back from the Brink by Peter Snowden, an account of what the Tories did in their wilderness years, and it's quite a good excavation of that period where no one was really paying that much attention to the inner workings of the Conservative Party. You knew what you felt you needed to know about Ian Duncan Smith and William Hague, unless you're an absolute political obsessive or an aspiring Tory. And watching David Cameron rise and George Osborne rise very gradually through the ranks, and how they positioned themselves, how they were converted to the modernising project up until the moment when they're on the threshold of power, it's a very good narrative and quite a good lesson for Labour now to understand some of the processes that they are going to have to go through and the dangers of obsessing about themselves as a party and forgetting that they also have to speak to a country.
There are signs that people are doing that. There's a thing called the Latimer Project, which is run by people like Will Straw, which was, they've looked at what happened to the Democrats when they were out of power and also what happened to the Tories. And they've sort of isolated things that they did very effectively, processes rather than just luck. And so it's things like what the Tories were quite successful at was moving the kind of cultural groups like the Taxpayers Alliance, by kind of using these third party groups, you change the agenda because you're just the noisiest ones. And then you turn it into, it's like what we were talking about earlier, the kind of how have they managed to paint Labour into this box of being responsible entirely for the economic downturn. And it's partly because they basically shift the centre ground.
I think the Tories did quite a lot of going to America and looking to America, and I think Labour in opposition could well learn from that. The whole nudge theory, of course, the Tories got quite keen on, and they did quite a lot on the psychology of voting and why people do that. And I think we didn't really know that was going on at the time. It emerged a bit later on when we found out what they'd been studying, who they'd been talking to in the States. But I think that is a good lesson for Labour. Have a look over there and see what they're doing.
But it's also very important to recognise when you've lost an election and have been rejected by the electorate, that there's a period during which you essentially have been mandated by the country to be quiet, and how to manage that and how not to crave some of the attention and the media impact that you automatically got as a cabinet minister or as a prime minister, without accidentally wandering off into irrelevance because you're not communicating. And that balance is very difficult for them to strike in this first year when it's all been about the coalition.
Well, this is all quite serious stuff. Of course, the publishing event of next year will be Allegra Stratton's book about the Milibands. But in the...
And she hopes the drama continues. Come back, David.
Yeah, come back. The return of the king. But in the meantime, the gossip has been provided really by Peter Mandelson more than anyone else, wouldn't you say, Allegra?
I don't read these books. I'm really
bad.
I know, I'm a really bad correspondent. My best book of the year, I don't think it was published this year, it's a really good book, everyone should read, Last Campaign, about Bobby Kennedy's 82-day campaign. And it's gripping and brilliant. And a lot of politicians I know, a lot of Labour politicians have read it recently as well, because it's quite a good kind of innovation in campaigning. He just went on this Free at Last tour, it's called the Free at Last tour, and he just sort of went out and met loads of people and didn't really do kind of Washington politics. Didn't end very well though.
I still think the best book of the year was Tony Blair's, actually, to my
very
amazement.
Readable.
I was expecting it to be quite dull, but he was so human. All these little touches about being terrified of Prime Minister's questions and announcing to Cherie one day in bed that he was going to get the Labour leadership and all this extraordinary stuff that you just didn't
weird
expect.
Definition of a drink problem, though.
Absolutely. We were worried about that, didn't we? But I thought it was frankly very readable in a way that I was expecting Peter Mandelson's to be. But no, Blair, I think, definitely took the edge there.
It was very... Do you read much of it, Rafa?
I have to admit, I agree. Certainly that the moments where he describes the deep anguish about Prime Minister's questions was one of the more humanising things I've actually read in The Politician. An interesting book this year that wasn't published is the book that Andrew Adonis, Lord Adonis, was
very
preparing to write about the coalition negotiations, and for various reasons about which people can happily speculate, decided not to publish and not to be damned.
He wrote a good couple of newspaper articles about the kind of stuff and the lessons for Lib Dems. What's your theory as to why that didn't see the light of day?
Well, he's working for the Institute of Government, and they have to be non-partisan, and I think it was felt that it would have been...
They read it,
it would have been
they?
Very hard to be non-partisan as a minister in the Labour government. But nonetheless, it did allow David Laws and others to give their account of how the negotiations worked, and Labour people had to try and rebut that reactively, which was quite interesting.
Michael, you've been uncharacteristically silent through the discussion so far. What did you think was the publishing moment of the year?
Well, it was almost certainly a work of fiction, but I tend to regard the ones that get the awards as usually a bad sign. I bought the Booker Prize winner Thingy's Thing. What was it?
Finkelstein question.
The Finkelstein
question.
Isn't it? on my new... I'm sharing this with you, Tom. On my new Kindle, as a gesture of goodwill towards the author whom I'd not previously read. And, you know, I'm finding it a struggle, although I'm getting on top of the Kindle slowly. But that's not the question you really asked me, was it?
No, you're showing a bit too much hinterland, Mike.
Except to say that
politics.
Political memoirs are usually a disappointment. I thought Tony Blair's was interesting. I didn't read it all. I thought he was trying in a funny way to be honest. He was trying to be different. He made a fool of himself over various things, including, you know, little coy sexual hints, which we could all have done without. And our colleague Julian Glover, sadly not present this morning, made an interesting point in which he said Brown's doer, slightly swivel-eyed memoirs talking about nothing personal but all about the global economy and his status as a master of the universe, was revealing in a
totally different but equally egotistical way, and that intrigued me. Of the books about Brown, I feel the need to make a plug for Steve Richards, who wrote what I thought was a grown-up book about Gordon Brown, which tried to acknowledge his strengths as well as his weaknesses. But even Steve kept deploying adjectives like deranged and demented with rather more regularity than I would have felt tactful. Peter Mandelson's, I checked myself out in the index, the brief reference.
The first thing journalists do when they get the book.
Didn't get there. There's a famous Norman Mailer and who's his great enemy in the New York?
Gore Vidal.
Of course, in one of Vidal's books in the index, he puts under Mailer Norman, High Norm, which is a way of addressing this particular problem. Peter Mandelson, I didn't get very far with. Who have I missed?
What about the David Law? What about the Coalition books?
Oh, no, I haven't had David Law's book. He barely had time, you know, to get his jacket off. Smart fellow though he is, I didn't know. I relied upon you, Allegra, to tell me what was in that book.
I think the Mail on Sunday told us what was in that.
Well, there we have it. I hope that's helped everyone with their last minute Christmas shopping, or not.
No.
He's eating a mince pie.
Hey, we're in the festive spirit, but my hand hovered over Gordon's book in the bookshop only yesterday, and it sort of hovered and then shrunk back.
And our colleague...
everyone's Christmas stocking.
Our colleague Julian Glover claims that he went into a shop and tried to buy it and was pointed towards a book with a picture of a fish on the front. Oh, you mean Gordon Ramsay, not Gordon Brown. Anyway, we'll leave that there.
Well, that's all we have time for, and we're taking a break for a few weeks too. Politics Weekly will be back in January with the best comment and analysis from Westminster and beyond.
So it remains for Allegra Stratton and myself, Tom Clark, to say Merry Christmas to one and all, and thanks to Michael White, Jackie Ashley, Raphael Bear, and remotely, Julian Glover.
The producer was Phil Maynard. Thanks very much for listening.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.